From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The faces of anorexia are changing. They're getting younger, a lot younger. Five-year-olds who say they are too fat and refuse to eat. It's not unusual, say today's guests, to see seven-year-olds on an inpatient unit. It is very troubling and a very frightening situation for many families. This hour, On Point, anorexia and young children. You can join the conversation. Are you dealing with this right now with your own family? Is our weight-obsessed culture to blame? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Omaha, Nebraska, is Kaylin Oler. She's 24 years old. Anorexia has been part of her life for 16 years. She was first diagnosed in the fourth grade. She now works part-time as a psychiatric technician with the Eating Disorders Program at Children's Hospital and Medical Center in Omaha, and she's working toward a degree in social work. Kaylin, welcome to On Point.
Hello.
Well, we're grateful that you're here and that you would share with us your experience. I know it's been a difficult road for you. You started comparing your weight to others in kindergarten, right? Take us back and describe what you were feeling then.
That is correct. You know, for me, I just remember feeling as though I somehow didn't fit in. I remember feeling that the other girls in my class were prettier, that they were better, and I just had those dark feelings of jealousy and not feeling like I had worth, you know, and those are challenging feelings for someone so young to feel because they don't necessarily know how to express it to adults or to really recognize what those feelings truly mean.
So you didn't tell anyone, you didn't tell a parent or a teacher or express how you were feeling necessarily?
No, not at all.
And then your dieting began soon after, as I understand it. You heard a presentation about healthy eating. Tell us about that.
I did. In fourth grade, during one of my PE classes, we were taught about dieting. And, you know, the topic was discussing how pretty much America was in an obesity epidemic and that if we continued to eat these certain foods, you know, and order, you know, supersize this and supersize that. And, you know, it wasn't clearly stated as best as it could have been. I don't feel, looking back, you know, we were taught that, you know, some of the favorite foods that America loves, you know, that they were bad. Mm-hmm. And I felt like foods were put into good and bad categories. And that was when I had learned to read food labels. And already, you know, we were being told to, you know, to read food labels and, you know, to watch out for calories and fat grams and sugar and things like that. And that low fat was better. And so those things, while the message was meant to be good, I didn't take it as that. The message that I had received was that being bigger was undesirable, and that, you know, since I wasn't already feeling positive about myself, I didn't want to become that. And so that just began a very long road. And my first interactions with dieting.
And did you gradually just pull back from food? Did you stop eating altogether? I mean, how did that work?
No, I made significant cuts in my diet, and I know that my parents can remember this. There's no doubt in my mind that they do, but you know, I had stopped eating most of the foods that I enjoyed, and, you know, I was very selective, and, you know, that was kind of when I started making up excuses, you know, that I'd already eaten, and, you know, that I wasn't hungry, or I would avoid around meal times, you know, or push my food around the plate, you know, anything that I could do to avoid, you know, family dinners.
And did your parents entice you, let's go out for ice cream today, Kaylin? Did they notice something was wrong and try to pull you back into some of your favorite foods?
You know what? I was such a normal kid, and, you know, so I don't think that my parents thought anything of it, you know, because, you know, at times, like, it didn't seem so drastic, and, you know, because I made things seem as though they were still normal, even though within my own mind or secretly behind doors, they were anything but that.
You made things seem so normal, and yet you were only in the fourth grade, right?
Yes.
And so then describe that first intervention, some of those early interventions. Did you go willingly?
No. The first time that I had started seeing someone was because I had let my best friend know some of the things that I was doing. And out of concern, you know, she expressed her concerns to her mother, who recognized, you know, that those were some of the things that she had battled with when she was younger, because her past, you know, included an eating disorder as well. And so I remember when she talked to my mom, and, you know, that was the first time that I was introduced to a nutritionist who was specialized in eating disorders. And such a lovely woman, and I know that she and I both look back and laugh now, but, you know, I fought her every step of the way, and, you know, unfortunately, you know, I wasn't honest with her because I felt like everything that she was saying was wrong, and I felt like my way was right, and, you know, I was already quickly enmeshed in the eating disorder.
So you fought her, you weren't honest with her. I mean, clearly, I guess then you didn't get what was going on. You didn't understand necessarily that you had a problem. You were so young.
I was young, and even though I knew that something was wrong, I still, you know, there was that underlying belief in me that, you know, I just wanted to feel acceptable, and I just wanted to you know, feel okay with myself. And so I didn't want that one thing that I believed that would get me that to be taken away.
So here you are in was it an outpatient facility in fourth grade, fifth grade, sixth grade?
Sixth grade was the first time that I went to a treatment facility, and it was pretty much a day program from, you know, 7:30 in the morning till 7:30 at night.
And so when you were there with other kids in this therapy group, were you frightened? Were you envious of their thinness? I mean, what was going through your mind in this very difficult state?
It was different for me, you know, leaving sixth grade and being away from my family, you know, and, you know, being with these girls who were much older than I was, you know, and hearing their stories and the things that they go through, it made me feel like I wasn't alone. You know, in a way, it made me feel like I wasn't so crazy, you know, because some of the things that I were doing, I didn't even get. And, you know, I envied their thinness, and not necessarily even knowing why at times, because I knew that it wasn't healthy, and I knew the things that I wasn't doing, you know, that they were unhealthy and that mm-hmm. they were damaging my body. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that I was still able to fully process that because I was so obsessed with achieving that acceptability and achieving this feeling that I had been longing for.
So what finally worked for you, Kaylin? What made you realize that this was real, that, you know, you had a disease, you had a sickness, you had anorexia?
You know, very, very soon after that, you know, and like I said, at that point I knew that something was wrong. But for me, it was almost, you know, I went in and out of treatment pretty much, you know, throughout all of my years of school. And, you know, I didn't care necessarily about the things that I was doing to myself because I had no value. I felt like I had no self-worth and I didn't care about myself. You know, so I just, unfortunately, didn't have a whole lot of love for myself. It wasn't until 2009 that my eyes were really opened when a friend of mine lost her life. And I know that, you know, I used to hear stories about, you know, that this can happen and that can happen. And, you know, it's always that, you know, oh, it happens to everybody else. And, you know, you don't even think that it's going to happen to somebody that's close to you. But when it does, you know, your world breaks and you see the hurt in the families and, you know, you feel it within your heart because you know that you're not that far from that. And just seeing her life, you know, one day just taken away from something that was so near and dear to me, you know, it was definitely scary. Mm-hmm. And, you know, part of me envied it at first because mm-hmm. I was so tired of struggling and I was so tired of being in that darkness and feeling like there was no hope and that I was never going to overcome this. You know, and so even after that point, I just felt like I had given up. And it wasn't until, it wasn't until 2010 that I just, I just had this feeling that my life wasn't going to be much longer if I didn't do something, if I didn't start caring about myself. And so I started seeing how on earth I was going to ever pay for treatment because it is so expensive and I didn't have any insurance. And so I had come upon a nonprofit organization who gives scholarships away for treatment for people who can't afford it. And, you know, I didn't know what my chances were of getting a scholarship. I figured that they were very far and few in between, and I had been turned down for some before because I was told that, you know, they would rather have somebody who had a better chance at recovery, because the longer that you struggle, especially, you know, after 10 years, you know, the chances of recovery are less likely. And since I had had so many, I guess you could say, failures in treatment, that, you know, that they just didn't want to take that risk on me. But this foundation did. And they, you know, they prayed with me and they believed in me and they were willing to fight for me. And so that's what changed it. They really blessed my life.
Saved your life, sounds like it. Kaylin Oler, I am so appreciative of your candor and your honesty. Please stay with us. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about this disturbing rise of anorexia. Here's a 2011 ABC Nightline interview where reporter Andrea Canning asked a six-year-old pre-kindergarten student named Taylor why she wanted to lose weight. Here's the exchange with Canning first.
Do you think sometimes your tummy is too big?
Sometimes.
And you want to lose weight in your tummy?
Yeah.
Why do you want to lose weight?
Because I don't like to be, like, my way, and my teacher always tells me that I have to run so I can be really, really not like this size.
Well, our guest this hour, Kaylin Oler, she was diagnosed with anorexia in fourth grade. She now works on the Eating Disorders Unit at Children's Hospital and Medical Center in Omaha. And joining me now from Denver, Colorado, is Dr. Jennifer Hagman, Director of the Eating Disorders Program at Children's Hospital Colorado. She is Associate Professor of Pediatrics at the University of Colorado. Dr. Hagman, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Jane.
So it's such a difficult topic, and Kaylin's story, I mean, what she's overcome is quite incredible. What do you hear in her story?
Well, I think Kaylin is remarkably articulate about the experience of a young child developing anorexia nervosa, carrying it forward through high school, and then finally as a young adult finding the insight and motivation to reach out for recovery herself.
Describe for us the changing profile of the patients that you see, the fact that they're getting younger and younger.
Well, it's really quite remarkable. I mean, Kaylin's onset of illness would have been, you know, over a decade ago. And at that time, it was somewhat unusual to see really young children. Now, consistently for the last 5 or 6 years, we've had a need for a young child program, a full program for younger kids in our program at Children's Denver.
And why? What's at the core? What's at the heart of this? Why?
I really believe it has to do with our culture's preoccupation and focus on reducing the risk of obesity, which absolutely has a positive component to that message. But for the vulnerable child, and Kaylin described this very well, I hear time after time after time about the health class or the PE class where a focus on healthy eating is described, but the way the message is received by some of the kids in the class can often trigger the onset of fairly severe drive for thinness, body image dissatisfaction, cutting down on calories, and lead them down the path very quickly to anorexia nervosa.
So this drive for thinness, I mean, my question is, how do you delineate a kid who's a picky eater, going through a phase, you know, from one that really exhibits symptoms that parents need to address right away?
Right, and it can happen very quickly. The onset of anorexia nervosa in a child, in 1 month's time, a child can become very critically medically ill with restriction.
1 month's time? 1 month?
1 month. Younger children become medically unstable very quickly when they restrict, and they're very effective at restricting everything, food and water, and just deciding overnight almost sometimes, I don't want to be fat, I'm going to stop eating.
What do we know medically about anorexia? Can you describe for us the scientific and the psychological understanding of this disease?
Well, after all these years, we still don't have a solid etiology for onset of the illness. We do know that living in a culture that values thinness and dieting is much more likely to trigger the onset of this type of illness. Years ago, we thought this was more of a control issue, more of a psychological issue. Now we know from quite a few genetic studies, biological studies, that there are factors that biologically driven that place someone at much greater risk for the onset of an eating disorder with restrictive eating patterns or weight loss.
Genetic biological patterns are what?
Well, there's some large studies going on with the Price Foundation looking at the genetics of anorexia nervosa and looking for potential genes that may contribute. We don't know. We don't have the answers yet, but it's a remarkable study that we're hoping will provide some clues.
Is there a history of anxiety, depression? Is there a component of that in some of these cases?
Yes, it's quite common to find a family history of depression and especially anxiety in individuals who develop eating disorders. And there's also, if you have a sibling, a parent, a twin with an eating disorder, you're more likely to develop one as well.
Dr. Hagman, Kaylin, let's invite some listeners in here. Many of them want to join this conversation. Frederica is first. She's in Chaselle, Michigan. Frederica, welcome to the program. Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Go ahead.
Yes, my point is what I have noticed is that my 5-year-old daughter cannot eat because my husband will regularly, criticize my food, saying it's too spicy, too fatty, all mixed together. And now she also feels an aversion to food, I often feel like. And it's very heartbreaking for me to see. It's hard for me just to get her to eat anything. Mm. And my point is, I think when these kids get treated for an eating disorder, I think the whole family should get treated. I think there's a lot of comments that go on about food at our dinner table and about how it's too spicy, too mm-hmm. fatty, mm-hmm. It might resemble, something undesirable. Like
right. So it's it's not just about your daughter, Frederica. It's about the whole family. Thank you so much for your call. Kaylin, let me turn to you. Was that helpful for you, for your whole family to sort of tackle this, to get treatment for this?
I definitely think that the family is a vital resource in all of this. I don't feel like it's just about the individual. It affects more than the individual. It affects the entire family. The family dynamics change dramatically. And, if just one parent is willing to, go to therapy and to nutrition counseling and things like that, but another parent isn't, it just does not work. And so, mm-hmm. I know that at times there were struggles within my family doing that. And for me, I didn't want my family to be a part of anything because I wasn't ready to give it up. But I do feel like that is an absolute necessary piece that must be implemented.
Kaylin, what does recovery look like for you on a daily basis? Every time you get up in the morning, what is recovery?
For me, recovery is just being able to live my life. For so many years, I spent life locked in a prison of my own mind, and today it feels absolutely amazing to not be bound by those chains or those bars because, I have the freedom to do what I want, to enjoy life again, to be able to laugh and to be able to, not have to think, what am I going to eat today? Or I can't do this because I don't feel like I look attractive or whatever negative thought it may be. My mind is no longer filled with those negative thoughts. More so, it is filled with gratitude because every day I wake up with the thought that I am so thankful to be alive because my life could have been taken away from me.
Here's another call from Elaine in Boston. Elaine, welcome to On Point. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
My point goes along the same lines of the American culture and our obsession with the obesity epidemic. I think a lot of it has to do with younger children almost mimicking parent behaviors. I know from personal experience, as young as 8 years old, hearing my uncles, my father, my grandfather having to go on cholesterol medicine, watch their high blood pressure, need to drop weight, and being concerned for my own future, you know, with the course of genetics. Mm-hmm. And I remember one Thanksgiving declaring I was on a no cholesterol diet, and I'm 8 years old, you know, not quite understanding that I don't need to really worry about that yet, but still reading labels, getting an obsession because I'm hearing about it through family talk.
Mm. Elaine, thank you for that important point. Dr. Hagman, what about that? Kids mimicking their parents, watching very closely what mom and dad are doing.
Exactly. It's very true. And I think Kaylin's point in the previous caller about the influence of comments families make innocently can really contribute to a child who's got their radar up about food and weight. And working with the entire family to heighten everyone's awareness of what they're saying about themselves, what they're saying about food, and how their behavior can really rub off on kids in the family.
Here's a clip, a CBS interview done with an Iowa mom who's sharing her fears for her 7-year-old daughter who's been battling anorexia since she was 4.
I would wake up in the morning hoping she was still going to be alive and then thinking, okay, now I got to start the day over again trying to get her to eat. It was awful.
Kaylin Oler, you're working with kids now in a unit, in an eating disorders unit there. When you look at them, when you work with them, what do you see? What are they saying to you? I mean, what's the sense that you get? Do you see yourself in them? Do you see something different?
I see pieces of myself in everyone that comes in, sometimes more than others, because, you know, they were the same age that I was. And I remember the feelings and I remember those same thoughts. And, you know, for some of them that come in, you know, you can just tell that they are not ready to give it up yet. And, you know, you can see that they're scared. And, you know, even though they feel like they're putting, you know, on a good show and, you know, that they're following everything that they need to be doing and, you know, declaring these things that, you know, they feel like they're getting better, you know, there's many times that I can see through that because I did those exact same things. And so it really allows me to be able to relate to them, but also to understand them. And, you know, for me, just being able to understand how scary and how difficult the process is, I feel like that gives me, you know, just a better understanding of how I can help them. And, you know, being able to, you know, just listen to them and not tell them what I think they need to do, but allowing them to, you know, express what they truly want and what and you know, and just where they're really at in their own recovery and in their own mind.
I'm curious, each child, each patient, probably at the root of it, there's something different, right? Self-worth issues, feeling like they don't have friends or pressures that that have been difficult to bear. As you look back on your odyssey, Kaylin, you talked about issues of self-worth, and but do you have clarity on what's really at the root of all of this for you?
You know, I don't, and that is something that I have given a lot of thought to over the years because I don't remember, you know, my mom or my sister or anybody really ever talking about dieting. You know, my family, you know, they just kind of did their own thing, and, you know, dieting wasn't a big part of our lifestyle, and, you know, by no means was anybody ever overweight, any, you know, but everybody was just happy and, you know, no major health issues, and so I don't really remember that. You know, I don't necessarily remember anybody ever calling me fat. You know, I remember being, you know, sometimes bullied here and there, but that was more so after after I had started struggling with an eating disorder. Mm-hmm. So I can't say that, you know, that was the root of it, although it didn't make things any better. You know, and so honestly, like, I don't know, you know, where it came from, I guess I could say. You know, I know that my family has, you know, kind of a history of addictions and, you know, feelings of depression and some anxiety. And so when we do look at it from all angles, I know that those are all contributing factors.
Here's another call from Farmington, Connecticut. Marie is on the line. Hi, Marie. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. Thanks
Hi.
For taking my call.
Of course.
I do think it's important to recognize that not all anorexics are alike and not all causes are the same. I have a daughter who developed anorexia at 12, and I remember at the time, so this would have been 8 years ago, I struggled to get her treatment because a lot of the facilities only treated kids who were 13 and up. And God forbid you have a boy who has anorexia, because I know they struggle even more to find programs geared to the males. But regarding my daughter, I mean, like Caitlin, your guest, she was very influenced by these well-intentioned PE or health teachers early on. I think in seventh grade, she said a teacher put a pound of fat in a baggie on the bulletin board and then told the students that, you know, they would have to run X number of miles to burn off that pound of fat. And my daughter, you know, the A-plus student really took that to heart. And this is what she's explained to us since, and luckily she's recovered. So I think these well-intentioned campaigns to stop childhood obesity and that we have in the United States right now, headed by Michelle Obama, I think they can backfire. I think there are some susceptible populations, especially girls, who can develop eating disorders as a result.
Marie, thank you.
That was the main point.
I really appreciate the call. Let's get Dr. Hagman's response to it.
I agree. I hear that story once a week from a child admitted to an inpatient program with medical instability. And I think, you know, working with the federal government about some of the way lessons are taught and the way kids are receiving the message is very important. And they are receptive to hearing that. It's just difficult. It's the Food and Drug Administration that we need to work with.
And yet trying to reach so many kids that are a part of this epidemic of obesity.
Right. It's the challenge of delivering a message in a way that doesn't increase vulnerability for 10 to 20% of the kids in the class.
Here's Ping from Boston. Ping, welcome to the program.
Oh, hi. I just want to make it quick. Well, I realized that my son lost like 30 pounds in half a year. And not just girls thing, lose weight. Mm. And I think when he was 14, he lost 30 pounds. And one of the reasons he wanted to punish me. So more, I don't understand that. But more I force him to eat, the more he doesn't want to eat, you see. Mm. But then I discovered something really powerful. He's influenced by baseball player and movie star. All this, he making song, making movie, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if we can get these celebrity people try to make a song or try to tell all the kids, you have to eat healthy. Mm. Indeed, my son never liked vitamin C, orange, but now he realized that the baseball player eating all the healthy salmon,
if fish. They say it's good, then he'll do it. Ping, it's a great point. Thank you, Dr. Hagman. The influence, the celebrity influence, the media influence, I guess it works both ways.
Right. No, I think Ping is making an excellent point that
yes.
The best way to counter, you know, broad public messages that are harmful in some ways or can be is with messaging that is, again, through the media and social media that is positive and, you know, encourages kids. You're so right that kids are very impressionable and oftentimes they'll take, you know, much more stock from a message from a celebrity than they will from their parents.
Kaylin, how did media influence affect you?
You know, it was a huge effect. It had a huge effect on me. I remember seeing commercials and, you know, just advertisements or, you know, just being flooded with those images of the super thin stars and, you know, just hearing that that is what is beautiful and that is what is desirable. And so for the longest time, I envy that and I strive to attain that unattainable perfection.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about the new faces of anorexia, very young children. We're speaking this hour with Dr. Jennifer Hagman, director of the Eating Disorders Program at Children's Hospital Colorado, and with Kaylin O'Lerm. She's first diagnosed with anorexia in fourth grade and is now working on the Eating Disorders Unit at Eating Disorders Program at the Children's Hospital and Medical Center in Omaha. She's pursuing also a degree in social work, Kaylin O'Ler. Here's a clip, an 8-year-old Dana talking about not wanting to eat and ending up in a specialized residential treatment center in London.
I didn't even know what anorexia was until my mom showed me on the internet, and everything that anorexia would have done, I was doing it.
Dr. Hagman, talk to us about what therapies work for these very young children.
Well, the good news is in the last decade, a treatment called family-based therapy, which actually originated out of a hospital in London, Maudsley Hospital, where they began treating the whole family, teaching the family, coaching them around what they needed to know to help their child recover, which was a very different approach than feeling as if the child needed to be removed from the family and treated by others. So family-based therapy has really become the best evidence-based approach to treating anorexia in children and adolescents.
So taking children out of the home doesn't necessarily work. What else does not work?
Well, we don't have medications that treat anorexia nervosa, so we know that that's not the right way to start. Just feeding the child without helping parents know how to approach meals, helping them know how to manage anxiety, manage the emotional and behavioral symptoms that come with an eating disorder. That's what you really need to do, is help the parents make the right interventions at home. Mm-hmm. Based it's much better to treat a child at home in the home environment than in a residential program.
I'm reading a story here of a mom who had to stand over her daughter, not stand over her, but sit with her at every meal, just to make sure that she would eat and eat the right things. So it's stressful, right, for the family to have to.
It is, but there's an important difference in what you said just there, is that you definitely don't want the parent, say, standing over the child.
Right,
you want the
right.
parent eating with the child, knowing how to be supportive, empathic, but firm, able to set appropriate limits, knowing when to step back from the eating experience and take a break and then enter it again. And it is very challenging for a family. I mean, you definitely, you know, need a lot of support, need to pay attention to your own self-care, keep your support network strong for yourself, because it is a marathon. It's not a one-month intervention and you're done.
Kaylin, would that have worked for you? Your mom or dad sitting down with you, talking to you about what was happening at the table surrounding food?
You know, my parents tried, and they did. You know, they sat with me, and they would, you know, get up with me in the morning. You know, and they tried a variety of things. And, well, sometimes that was helpful. There was other times when, you know, I still found myself being dishonest and, you know, trying to you know, deceive them, you know, that I was eating or that I wasn't eating. And a lot of it was to avoid conflict. And of course, there are just times when, you know, they would offer to sit down with me and, you know, to be of support to me, but I resisted, you know, their help.
And when, Dr. Hagman, is it time to get help?
Well, I think when your child is losing weight and you're not able to reverse that, you definitely need to see the pediatrician and start to explore, you know, what other alternatives you might need. I think the earlier parents seek help when they're concerned, when they start to see restrictive eating patterns, weight loss, negative comments about body, the sooner you intervene, the better chance you have of a good outcome. Mm-hmm. And there's still a third or more of individuals who develop anorexia nervosa will go on to have persistent illness, even with optimal intervention. So increasing your chance of a good outcome with early intervention is very important.
Let's go to Dallas, Texas. Dawn is on the line. Hi, Dawn. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I'm a member of five-generation family that struggles with eating disorders. Mm. I'm 45 and have struggled with anorexia and bulimia as long as I can remember. And now my 15-year-old son struggles. Mm-hmm. And we've had treatment. It's very difficult to find help, even when you are insured. And there seems to be, for me, it's you're right, it's a marathon, and it's incredibly difficult, especially when you're trying to obtain help for your child and you haven't been so great at even helping yourself.
Mm. So your 15-year-old is struggling now with these issues. When did you see it first in him?
Around 6 or 7, and like I said, I'm fourth generation out of five that struggled with eating disorders, remembering even my great-grandmother abusing laxatives and dealing with anorexia, and my grandmother, my mother, myself, and now my son.
Mm. Don, thank you. Dr. Hagman, I mean, there is a definite genetic component here.
There is, and it's very difficult in our culture. You realize how much of our lives revolve around food and exercise, but especially food. And it's very challenging to, you know, stay away from eating disorder behaviors when you've got a genetic drive towards dieting, restricting, body dissatisfaction, body image distortion.
Mm. Here's Catherine calling us from Medfield, Massachusetts. Hi, Catherine. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I want to comment and a question. My comment is based off of actually a previous caller when she spoke of the goodness of talking about childhood obesity and health classes. But I have a second grader. Her issue, and I've noticed that it's been getting worse and worse, she'll come home talking about, oh, mommy, we talked about this at school and health. Oh, mommy, we did this. And she, you know, I would give carrots with some ranch dressing. Mommy, we cannot have ranch dressing. That will make you really fat. Different things like that that have started to concern me. Also, she's divorced. And so with her father, he really reams it into her about eating healthy foods, which, of course, I agree with. But to a point where I'm starting to see little patterns here. And I'm also have another child from a different relationship, and she's four. I see my second grader, who are starting to have the issues, has approached my four-year-old and has said things like, don't eat that. That will make you fat. You have to promise me you won't eat that. Which are all sort of shocking to me.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen her get out of the shower, looking at herself in the mirror.
Mm-hmm.
And all these things are, this has been very helpful, this conversation, because my question then to the doctor and to all of you is really, what these little, you know, early intervention, you've been saying early intervention. So what are the things that you can do other than saying, oh, honey, don't worry about it. You're beautiful just the way you are. Or, like, are these things to be concerned about? You know, are these things just to blow off and say, oh, it's just nothing?
Mm-hmm.
So,
Catherine, thank you. I'm glad you called, and good luck with your little ones. You know, Kaylin, I'll start with you on this one. What do you think? And then Dr. Hagman.
You know, I think in this case, it's going to be vital that, you know, that there's conversation between both of the parents, because, you know, my question is, you know, is the father, you know, does he realize the impact that he's having? And, you know, I think that it's important to, while we're teaching children that, yes, there is a certain way, you know, to eat that is healthier, but that there is no food that is unhealthy in moderation, because, you know, as I've learned growing up and as I've learned through recovery, you know, food is meant to be enjoyed, and that there is no one food, and that, you know, food isn't what makes us, you know, overweight, but it's the amounts that we eat. And so, you know, I feel like that message is often lost, and it's either they're good foods, they're bad foods. You know, it's going to make you fat, but really that isn't the entire truth. And so I feel like, you know, again, parents and educators, you know, especially, you know, in the health fields and things like that, that they just need that extra education, and whether that be training or, you know, just acquiring it. Like, I feel like that is so important.
Dr. Hagman.
I agree with Kaylin. I think a balancing message is very important, talking with the other parent to make them aware of the impact on the child. And also, I really applaud the caller for having this on her parental radar for a second grader and a four-year-old. I think oftentimes parents think, oh, eating disorders don't happen until the late teenage years, and it's not even on their radar as a parent in a younger child. And I think the more you're aware of what your child might be struggling with, the more effective you can be in you know, asking questions, exploring what they're thinking, what they're feeling, and offering balance.
Because the yo-yo dieting and the weight loss as a very young child has a significant impact on the body, right? Physiologically, long term, what are those impacts, Doctor?
Well, that's true, that metabolism is impacted by patterns of starving and binging. Starving and going for long periods without eating definitely can affect your metabolism, and over the course of a lifespan, make efforts to maintain your weight in a healthy range more difficult.
A couple of callers, Doctor, have brought up the fact that this is not just girls who struggle with anorexia at young ages. It's boys, too.
Very true, very true, and I'm glad several of the earlier callers brought that up. It's been interesting that as the reach of anorexia nervosa has expanded beyond teenagers and young adults, at the same time that it's expanded into younger children, we've seen more males, including younger males, teens, and young adults.
Here's Lori in Buffalo, New York. Hi, Lori. Welcome to the program. Thank you for waiting. Hi.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. You know, I find this topic so important because as a child, I was overweight, struggled my whole life with trying to lose weight. And I feel like, you know, even throughout my teenage years, you know, I did do that yo-yo dieting. My first diet I was on, I was 13, and then lost 30 pounds, but then put on 40. And it kind of went through that whole phase my whole life. Mm-hmm. And then feeling horribly guilty about putting on the weight, that I'm not strong enough, that I'm not doing something, that there's something wrong with me. And so I feel like, you know, now, you know, as an adult, I have children, and I have been able to lose weight and maintain it. But I've only been able to do that through acknowledging, one is that there are some foods that I feel like aren't good for you. Like, you know, I know earlier you're talking about good or bad foods, but like, I know that when I have sugar, because I medicated myself with sugar when I was growing up, that when I have sugar, I crave more sugar. So I know that I have to really be on top of it and limit it and those kinds of things. And I feel like, as a mother, I have three children, and, you know, it takes a lot of time to maintain your weight. You have mm-hmm. to continue to, you know, as a yo-yo dieter, yeah. I have this problem. So I have to pay attention to it.
I think
always make sure that...
That's really important to be aware of it. Lori, I'm sorry to cut you off, but we have lots of others to get to, and I appreciate your call, Dr. Hagman. It is an awareness. It's a constant awareness, correct?
Very much so, but I think Lori's also raising an important point, and there's some really fascinating research work going on in brain imaging and eating disorders across the spectrum, binge mm-hmm. eating disorder, bulimia, anorexia nervosa, and there are definitely indicators that reward mechanisms in the brain respond differently to sucrose and sugar, different nutrients in different eating patterns and eating disorders. So I think there is something to be said for how the brain responds when you're eating, contributing to your risk of developing an eating disorder.
Susan is on the line from Wayland, Massachusetts. Hi, Susan. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Mm-hmm.
Just a couple quick points. I really appreciate all the comments by the callers and by the panel. One thing I wanted to bring up as kind of someone who's suffered throughout my life and kind of come to a good place now with bulimia, which I think is, I've always thought of as like anorexia, but just less self-control. These are issues that are so personal. They are paralyzingly personal to the people who suffer from them.
Mm-hmm.
And when we think about how to treat these girls, how to protect our daughters from eating disorders, we have to figure out ways to break through these incredibly sophisticated barriers and masks that, you know, we who suffer, that these girls who suffer put up. So that's the first point. I think it's a major control issue, and that usually in response, at least in my perspective, I think the panel seems to be differing in this a little bit, but I think it's a response to either your environment or a life event that's put you out of control, and it's mm-hmm. a way to gain mental
control. How to get that control back. I agree. And Susan, thank you very much for that. Kaylin, would you acknowledge that? Would you agree with the caller?
I do. I know that it didn't start out for me as control, but I know that it eventually became that. And I learned to, you know, numb my feelings and to, you know, avoid some of the hurts in my past, or, you know, just kind of whatever it was, through the use of restriction or over-exercising, and almost, you know, medicating myself in that way.
How would you say, Kaylin, that this disease has shaped your life, has changed your life? You're a young woman now. I mean, you've been struggling with this for so many years, diagnosed in the fourth grade. You've been dealing with anorexia for 16 years. How has it shaped you, and how is your recovery now?
You know, this whole journey has made me more self-aware, and, you know, before kind of all this happened, and even just during the midst of it, for me, my faith has been a huge thing, and I didn't have a whole lot of faith until I started recovery 3 years ago, and so my faith has grown immensely, and I know that that's just been a significant change for me. but it's also directed which path I want to take in life and just, you know, that I'm going into social work and that I want to work with individuals and families who suffer from eating disorders. And so it's really almost, you know, that's my purpose. And I feel like, you know, that this is just a strong testimony for me. But to also just bring hope to other people, too. And as far as today goes, you know, I have days that are a little bit tougher than others, but, you know, more so than not, recovery is amazing. And, you know, it's just awesome to be able to live life again.
Well, you have inspired us this hour, Kaylin. Thank you very much for being with us, for being willing to talk to us and share your story. Good luck to you, my friend.
Thank you so much.
And Dr. Jennifer Hagman from Children's Hospital Colorado, thank you very much, Doctor. We appreciate your insights.
Thank you, Jane and Kaylin.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, the Supreme Court heard a challenge to the Voting Rights Act. Is it still needed? We'll check in Shelby County, Alabama, to ask that question. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.